This is the Last Video Store, a nostalgic chamber to take you back in time to when you could pick a movie off the shelves, borrow it from a strange guy behind the counter, and take home for a certain amount of days. Then you have to bring it back to that strange guy and have a conversation with him. I am the other side of that conversation. My name is Alexi Toliopoulos, and this is the podcast where we're joined by guests and we go through some of their favorite movies in the style of an old school video rental combo. This week is a bit of a freaking special episode, baby. I'll be honest with you about that. It's a special one. We are celebrating the release of an Australian independent horror film that I absolutely love. It is called Late Night with the Devil. It stars David Esmalchian. It's directed by Cameron and Colin Cairns, who made another great Aussie horror comedy called 100 Bloody Acres that I absolutely freaking love as well. And who are the guests on this episode? Oh my God, it's the names I just mentioned. David Esmalchian and Colin and Cameron Cairns. We have got a killer episode. It's jam-packed with all this cool horror goodness. David Esmalchian will be on first. We're going to talk to him for a little bit about his performance and this film, Late Night with the Devil. And then we'll be joined by the brothers Cairns to talk about three of the films that influenced Late Night with the Devil. Let me tell you about Late Night with the Devil. It is set in 1977. It takes its form as a live-to-broadcast late-night talk show in the style of Johnny Carson, or more so for us Aussies, Don Lane. And there's a lot of Don Lane in this film, which is such an absolute delightful surprise. So it's framed like a little bit of a found item of that broadcast. There's all these great little verite moments in between when we cut to commercial break. But the premise of the film, Jack Delroy, the host, played by David Esmalchian, invites a purportedly possessed girl to be interviewed on the show. And that's just where things get started. So I implore you to go check out Late Night with the Devil in cinemas in Australia right now from today, April 11th. So go check it out. It's so fun. It's Australian made. It was filmed in Melbourne. And I'll tell you this, I think some of the things we do best in this country is genre cinema, and this is a testament to that. Okay, we're going to kick things off, babies, with our discussion with David Esmalchian about the making of Late Night with the Devil. And I'm going to say a couple of words before we get in. I absolutely love David Esmalchian. He's not just the lead of this film, but he's one of the great character actors popping up in Dune, The Suicide Squad, and I'll never forget the first time I saw him, which was in The Dark Knight, an absolute classic film. I remember seeing it in the cinema so well, down to every single second of it. He plays one of the Joker's henchmen who goes absolutely freaking wild in it. It was his first big screen performance, and I remember being so entranced by what he was doing, turning to my friend and just going, "Who the hell is this guy? He's amazing." And now I got to freaking talk to him. Another point I'll say, I didn't get to talk to him for too long. I had a really short window, and you can tell I'm pushing for as much time as possible. And you may even hear the voice of a lovely PR person, Carly, jump in to wrap things up for me. So that might be in there. Just a little warning, because I was being cheeky. I was a cheeky fella. What can I say, baby? I'm a cheeky guy. Hey, David, nice to meet you.
Great to meet you. How's it going? I love that that whole collection behind you. I can tell you're a true fan.
I truly am. And I absolutely love this movie. I love Late Night with the Devil. I've had a chance to see it twice now. And the thing that is interesting to me is the late night host that you remind me of most in the film and the show reminds me most is Australian host Don Lane. Is that something that came to
your research? It's amazing that you say that, Alexi, because when I was starting my prep work for the film, I was watching tons of video of Johnny Carson and David Letterman and Dick Cavett and other people that were from the States. But then Colin and Cameron Cairns, who were the brothers that wrote and directed this film, they sent me video of Don Lane. And I immediately go, this is my guy. He is totally perfect. And not only was he like so into the rhythm and the kind of cadence that I felt Jack Delroy was going to need to deliver, but Don Lane wasn't just a complete skeptic. He wanted to believe, and he would have people on his show, and he wasn't just making fun of them. He was actually like sincerely like interested in the other side.
That's so nicely put. And especially, I read about how you became involved in the film was the brothers found this article that you wrote for Fangoria about your love
Yes.
of horror, late night horror hosts. And I think that love really translate beautifully in your comic book series as well, Count Crowley.
Thank you.
They made with Dark Horse. I was wondering how that love translated to your performance here. What were you trying to embody? Were there any like characteristics that you captured onto?
Well, thank you for bringing up Count Crowley, by the way.
I love it. I
I
love
have
Camp Crowley.
always, I grew up in the 80s watching my local horror host, Cremation Mortem, where I grew up in Kansas City in the Midwest in the States. Cremation Mortem was, she was a ghoul, but she was incredibly hot to me. And she would introduce, the old Lon Chaney and Christopher Lee and Vincent Price movies and all the old, William Castle movies. And there was this era in the 80s with like her sets and the like Halloween decorations. And for me, listening to old Halloween records and the movies that were coming out at that time from people like John Carpenter and David Cronenberg and, so many artists. So that time is very special to me. So when this film came into my lap and Colin and Cameron asked if I wanted to be in the film, there were so many things about it that I loved, the script and the tone and the directors, but that nostalgic, like late 70s era of late night TV and horror stuff just seemed like such a fun, fertile playground to play in. And it spoke to me. If you've read Count Crowley, then you know how much I love that era. And I think that it's possible for us as writers and creators to wrestle with really complicated ideas about really difficult things, but through the lens of horror, whether it's with werewolves or vampires or zombies or possessed little girls. There's all kinds of stuff that we can really like explore in cool character building ways that still are done through the magic of horror.
I love the way you put it. The way that I think about it is genre is a language that audiences are completely fluent in, but they may not be conscious of that. So it's a really great way to communicate to people.
That's a great way to say it. It's true. I really think you have an opportunity to touch people's hearts and minds through genre in a way that you can't in other forms of filmmaking or comic book writing or story writing or any form of storytelling, theater, et cetera. There's something about transporting people. They're almost distracted by the mise-en-scene, by the monsters, by the fear, and what you're getting to when people are scared is create space within them, because then they laugh and they're comfortable and they realize, oh, it was just a scare, it was just a movie. And it really opens up the opportunity to like let people think about how we treat people who are different from us, how we deal with processing grief, trauma, stress, how we push ourselves, how we abuse ourselves. There's so many ideas that play in the really well-done movies of horror, and I think that audiences don't even have to be conscious of it, you know?
Another aspect of Late Night with the Devil that I'd love to talk to you about in terms of your performance is there's the artifice of the film, that aesthetic artifice of it being shot and looking like a late night talk show, intercut with, more diegetic or verite moments in between, like in the ad breaks. But when it comes to your performance, how was that playing in the style and like the setups of a late night talk show? Was it freeing? Was it a challenge?
It was very freeing for me to show up at Docklands Studios in Melbourne with Colin and Cameron Cairns, who wrote and directed the film, and seeing the space that they'd created for me to bring Jack to life. Because what they did is they built a very authentic feeling television set from the 1970s. Our production designer, our costumer, our hair and makeup team, everybody did such an amazing job bringing that spirit of that time to life. So by the time I stepped foot on set, it felt like I was back on the stages of Chicago theater, where I was surrounded 360 degrees by the world that we were creating with our imaginations. I've got a live band playing me in and out every time I come on set. I've got this kick-ass, just like totally weirdly colored, vibrant 70s vibe It was just such a gift. As an actor, you rarely get to play in a space that feels like it's that lived in. So that was really cool for me.
And like the practicality of it, was it something to like something, I don't know how else to phrase it, but like playing in those confines of it being shot in that style and kind of like in that kind of shape of a late night talk show, how was that to play with, especially like tracking like the psychology of your character who is crumbling on the inside while trying to keep it together with like wit and banter on the outside?
That's me, though. That's what I have to do. Like, I sit here getting to talk to you and all the other press today, and I love it. It's wonderful. It's important. I'm talking about something I care about, and I'm not being some fake, inauthentic a-hole. I mean, I'm genuinely wearing one of my true masks. I'm getting to promote a thing I love. I'm trying to talk about something I care about, but we have these very brief little bites of time that we have to try and share all this information. And 2 hours ago, I was having to go for a walk because I was struggling with anxiety and feeling like under a lot of pressure for things that have nothing to do with the Zooms that I was going to do today. And I'm like, that is Jack Delroy. He's the face of this talk show host. He's got to be on. He's got to be funny. He's got to give good, jokes. And then as soon as they yell cut to commercial, you see this guy who is drinking his liver rotten, who's not processing the grief of losing his wife recently, who feels so much pressure to make his show succeed that it's caused him to squeeze the life out of his own body. That's powerful stuff to me. And you know what? It's just at the end of the day, some people could watch and go, that was a fun, cool horror movie. And that's all it needs to be. But for me to get into it and bring something interesting to life, I like to go to that place.
David, one final thing. The show that I host is kind of all about evoking that powerful nostalgia of discovering film through the video store. I was wondering, do you have any memories of a video store that you grew up with discovering films? Especially, I know you're a genre horror fan.
Perfect question for me. I used to ride my bike a mile. I lived off 103rd and Quivira Streets in Kansas before that area was developed. So it was like almost farmland. Now it's all suburban, beautiful stuff, but it was just farmland. There was this one road, 103rd Street. I would ride my bike all the way up 103rd Street, usually by myself, sometimes with my best friend, Steve Armstrong. My parents had a membership at Wyclef Video. It was a family-owned video shop in a
Wow.
little strip mall next to the Godfather's Pizza and the Skate City Roller Rink. And when you'd go in there, your parents had a card on file, so you could rent up to three films at a time. It was like a monthly service fee. During the summer or weekdays, when I knew that my parents weren't going to be renting anything, I knew I could rent stuff. And then as long as I got it returned in time, no one would know. And the teenagers behind the counter could give a crap what this, third, fourth, fifth grade kid was renting. So that's how I walked down the aisle, always went straight to horror and sci-fi, and I found Aliens and Halloween, and I found Wizard of Gore, and I found I Spit on Your Grave, and I found Children Shouldn't Play with Dead Things, and all of everything, from Herschel, the great Gordon Lewis. I was watching Reanimator 2 movies and Stuart Gordon stuff, or looking at French and Italian horror. It was like, what a gift the video store was to us. I miss those days.
Have you had much chance to explore into Australian horror since working on Late Night with the Devil?
I've
Sorry to
always
jump
loved
in,
Australian
Alexi.
horror. We're at time. I'm sorry.
Oh, no
Thank
worries.
you.
Thanks so
Australian
much,
horror.
David.
Big fan of movies like Wolf Creek, and I love the Cairns brothers. And I mean, there's so many great Australian horror filmmakers. As you guys are really messed up down there, and I love it.
Thanks so much. And by the way, I love the movie Relaxer, one of my favorite movies of yours.
Thanks, man. I'll tell Joel you said that. That's awesome. See you later.
See you later.
Bye.
So that was my chat with David Smilch, and you can tell I was freaking hyped. Okay, I was hyped. I'm a hyped guy. What can I say? I was hyped in that moment. We're gonna jump into our last video store with Colin and Cameron Carnes. And I'm gonna give them a little bit of a different combo this week, trying something out. We're gonna give them the filmmaker combo, one new release, which has to be their movie that they have got in cinemas right now, and then three weekly titles, which are films that had a meaningful influence in some kind of way on the film they are promoting. Let's get into it.
New release.
Cameron and Colin Cairns, thank you for joining me within the catacombs of The Last Video Store.
Pleasure to be here.
Thanks for having us, Alexi.
The pleasure is all mine, but I might share a little bit with you guys as well. I'm that kind of generous guy. But I'm very excited to have you in here because we're going to give you the filmmaker combo here at the video store, which is one new release film, which happens to be one that you guys have just directed and released. And then we're going to go through three films that in some way inspired it, influenced, gave you some kind of creative kick with it. And your new release film, Late Night with the Devil, is a film I absolutely love.
Horror.
I'm so thrilled by it. To kick things off, I might start with one of the most basic bitch questions that I have in my arsenal. Can you tell me about the genesis of the film?
Sure. The genesis. You're the genesis guy, right? I'll do the genesis. He'll do the genesis and I'll do the collapse and destruction bit. The Armageddon. I'll do Armageddon.
Perfect. Perfect.
Well, we almost have to go back to biblical times.
Let's go all the way back.
It was 1977. Mm-hmm.
Look, I think really the idea came about 10 years ago when we'd come off 100 Bloody Acres and our producer was very keen to roll into another horror film. Mm-hmm. So she was asking us, and we kind of knew we weren't going to have that much money. So
the first film bombed.
Yeah.
It's a great film, though. Very funny.
Thank you.
Yeah, I love it.
Yeah, so did the other 100 or so people. Who no, actually, well, there was quite a few who downloaded it.
It was downloaded.
It was. I do remember it being a pirated film, but I'll tell you, I paid for it, okay? I am innocent.
Yeah, and then just ourselves and immersing ourselves in that world, watching lots of old clips of Cavett and Carson and also, you know, our homegrown heroes like Don Lane.
There's a lot of Don Lane in the
More than we probably realized as we were writing it, because that's what we grew up with. We were watching Don in the 80s and, yeah. But, yeah, the script, it was hard because, you know, we're trying to make a horror movie, but it's not like a classic, you know, the classic horror movie now has got to have 10 jump scares in the first 5 minutes. And we couldn't do that, you know. We had to be true to that world and just slowly bring the creep factor into it. So, yeah, it was just a big juggling act in the writing, trying to get the balance right between just that bright and breezy, you know, banter, the sort of late talk show sort of vibe, and the supernatural element. So it was a lot of shaping over a number of years.
Yeah.
Well, not always that slow, but we took our time on this one.
Hey, well, I think it's worth all that time in the incubator because I think especially the way you kind of construct the film's aesthetics of like having this outward witty banter kind of like calm, but as it starts crumbling underneath and the facade starts dropping, I think it just works so wonderfully. I was wondering if we could talk about that aesthetic with that multicam kind of studio setup and then the way that you kind of break that up with when we cut to ad breaks, these more verite style, like interstitial moments of truth behind it. Was that always the way that you kind of thought about it, or did that slowly evolve over the process of constructing the film?
I think we knew early on that the whole methodology of shooting a TV show was going to work for this. Having three cameras rolling all at the same time was just going to be really liberating for our cast and also for us, and not having to worry about setups, and which, you know, just, you know, when you've shot a scene and you shoot the next scene, it can take, you know, up to an hour before you're shooting again. So I think we knew early on that we were going to have a bit of freedom in the shooting of it. So it was just something we fully embraced, and so did our collaborators. I don't know if I've
You've answered the first half of
there
it.
Was
I'd
a second
say.
Part.
It's part two. I'll try.
I'm throwing to you for part two.
Here we go. So, but then, the ad breaks, that was, and you know, your point about that evolving, it did. Like, we tried every sort of variation on how that could be tackled. You know, I think there might have been a version where it was just, you don't see anything for 3 minutes. You know, it's like, it is literally someone, the master tape from the studio with just color bars or, what do you call it? The test pattern. The network test pattern.
Yeah.
And then there was a version where the studio cameras, the pedestal cameras, just kept rolling but weren't framing up on anything. So it was just like cutting from one ugly wide to a out of focus shot of someone's feet, and you just happen to hear the salient information that would help fill in the gaps. But then we thought that doing that might be cool for the first break or two, but then would become really contrived when every time we go there, you just happen to be hearing all this key information.
Yeah.
So ultimately it was like, well, you know, why wouldn't they be shooting sort of a behind the scenes doco? It's this big night. It's the biggest night of Jack's life. And this idea also that there's this French documentary crew that's been maybe following his story and what's going on with the Grove and all these other sort of potentially sinister, organisations that play a part in the film. So once we settled on that, it just felt like that was the best way to get that information across, to reveal more about these characters, the truth of these characters and what's at stake. And then when you've made that choice, it's a matter of, again, like with the TV show, making that feel as kind of as authentic, you know, to the time and place as possible.
Yeah, I think we were only sort of putting a finer point on it.
Yeah.
In the later drafts, I don't think we ever sort of referred to the documentary crew or this sort of Pennebaker, you know, style documentary. That's I think, you know, it was in our heads, it was more Larry Sanders. And when you got, you know, cut from the TV show stuff to the behind the scenes stuff, it felt very Verite without sort of saying it was.
It wasn't,
observational, fly on the wall. And I think, you know, that was our intention going in, and we'll never refer to the doco crew and just let people hopefully just, you know, fall into that world and suspend disbelief.
Hell yeah. I love to hear that. I was catching up with a friend of mine, a colleague, Alexandra Helen Nicholas, and we made the observation that right now in the new wave of Australian horror, there's like this little current of possession films, including Late Night with the Devil, Talk to Me, Godless, The Eastfield Exorcism, The Possessed. Now, you don't have to answer this question, but what do you think is up with that?
Well, and you're right, and it's not just here. It's, you know, the Immaculate has just opened the same day as us in America.
Yeah.
The First Omen.
I'm sure we could think of others, but
yeah,
what's
Ghostbusters up? Maybe? I haven't seen it, but I'm assuming there's some shit like that in there.
Okay. You know, there are cycles, I guess, in horror, and maybe we're going through the possession cycle right now.
Yeah.
But I don't think it really goes away, you know. It's just one of those ideas in horror that, you know, we keep returning to for whatever reason. Why it's hot right now, I don't know. I think has it got something to do with our recent past and, you know, us all being stuck inside with each other and going a bit crazy
Okay.
I don't know.
I think you may have got the answer, because when you said that last bit, I did feel a chill. That's how I know when something's real. Good, right? A chill passes through me. I go, okay, the point has been made. We've got something in stone now.
Yeah, particularly in Melbourne. I mean, all of Australia had it, except Perth, I guess. But we're just in the States and talking about that same thing with people there. Yeah, I think it's still – everyone's a little bit triggered. It's like, do we have to talk about that? So maybe these films are a way of dealing with it in a way.
Wow.
Cathartic. Yeah.
All right. Well, consider me catharsized. I feel absolutely catharsized right now. Guys, I got to say, I absolutely love Late Night with the Devil. And I'm sitting here looking at your picks for what the three films that you chose that influenced it in some kind of way, or perhaps gave you a possession of your own to, you know, to spill the rest of the movie out. And I reckon it's time we should go through those weekly titles.
Weekly.
Let's start with the first one from director Martin Scorsese, perhaps one of my favorite films by him, and each time I revisit, I love it even more. You have chosen After Hours.
Yes.
Cult.
Yes, we love that movie. It is one of his best.
When we saw it as kids, we loved it instantly. I don't think we knew much about Martin Scorsese at the time. Mm-hmm. Maybe we'd seen Taxi Driver, but the whole, maybe, you know, who was responsible for it didn't really, you know, gel with us. So it was just about that movie and that experience, watching it as kids and being swept up in that story and that sort of nighttime world.
Yeah, real time, nocturnal, you know, a man at his wit's end, downward spiral. Yeah, I mean, it's something we refer to in everything we make, like, just because it's so beautifully constructed and made, and the pacing of it, and it's a black comedy, I guess you'd say. And it was funny, you know, we when the film premiered in Brisbane, we grew up in Brisbane, by the way, and we'd have seen that film at the old Village Twin in New Farm.
I love that cinema. It's great, isn't it? Yeah,
and it's all very mid-century with the bricks and the carpet.
Yeah. It's stunning, right? Absolutely stunning.
It's got to be. They've got to. We asked if it was heritage listed. They said no. I said, well, you've got to get under that.
Okay.
There's nothing like that in Melbourne. There's nothing left. Nothing. I think.
I'll join that petition right now. We need to save that cinema from ever changing.
It's so cool. But that's where we saw. So that's where we premiered Late Night with the Devil at the Brisbane Film Festival.
Oh, perfect.
And it's where, and we hadn't been there for 30 years or whatever it was. And it's where we saw After Hours. I saw it twice in a week, I recall. So that, yeah, it's just one of those films that I think has, it's...
The music as well, the Howard Shore score.
Oh, amazing.
I think we might have temped with it for some of Late Night.
Yeah. It's that ticking clock, that kind of metronome quality of that score Howard Shore.
And it's building to something, like the alarm is about to go off and you're never quite sure when. And I think that's kind of the atmosphere we do try to create with Late Night. You know, it's building to this a moment in time, you know, midnight basically. The show starts at 10:30.
I got to say, when I saw this film come up in your bundle, I was thrilled. And if anything, it immediately enriched how much and why I love Late Night with the Devil. Because to me, to go, okay, we're making a movie about like a late night talk show, what are the vibes you want to construct? It seems like... It should seem like a no-brainer, but it also seems like a kind of genius, esoteric peak to go, well, why don't we look at one of the great nocturnal films ever that kind of captures, I think, what Scorsese does so well in that film, of the journey of like an everyday, button-pushing, regular, bureaucratic man who gets swept up in the cycle of the night as it becomes more surrealistic. He goes on this journey to kind of bring that into a closed space. I think that's what makes the film sing so well.
Right. Good to hear.
Thank you. Yeah. That's right. And After Hours, the later it gets, the weirder it gets.
Yeah, really escalates.
This whole sort of insomnia that everyone in that, like, it seems like half of New York is awake at 3 a.m. and part of some vigilante group or whatever. That we kind of imagine being outside the studio at the end of Late Night. You know what I mean? Like, it's an odd one because it's not by any means a horror movie, but it's a suspenseful.
Probably the more obvious one when you think of Scorsese. And look, don't get us wrong, that found its way in as well. But I think it is more just a tone thing of that film of After Hours.
And as well, that ensemble in After Hours being built by such kind of like an esoteric range of actors, varying from kind of like intense personalities, and then also like comic actors like Terry Garr doing like a really fun comedic performance, and Catherine O'Hara, so many, like just a broad range of people.
Yes.
And Cheech and Chong, like everyone is so interesting.
Fun fact, we saw Tommy Chong at the cinema where Late Night was playing in Santa Monica. We were doing a Q&A there. And when we saw Tommy Chong walk in, I got really excited. Tommy's
going to come and see our movie.
And then he walked off to see Ghostbusters.
So close, so close. You've got to get him in somehow. Put him in the next film, I reckon.
Yes.
Yeah. That was so hilarious. But speaking of sort of chance encounters in LA, we did bump into Joe Dante. Dante walking out, believe it or not, of a screening of Late Night with the Devil. So we went up to Universal City, walking in one of the big, near Universal Studios. It's a big shopping complex there and a multiplex. And we just got out of the car park. We were just going to look around and do a bit of, you know, be tourists, do a bit of shopping. And who should walk by but Joe Dante and his wife.
Oh my God.
And we just stopped. Mr. Dante, we're from Australia Brothers. We've just made a film. Be great if you could. He said, I just saw your movie.
No way.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he approved. Apparently,
He's
been saying nice things. So that was just a huge buzz and an honor. And that was like
an absolute hero. Meeting him. Well, you know,
I mean, obviously, like you got like one of the kings of horror comedy. Of course, you guys must like completely idolize him.
Yeah. Yep. something. I mean, we could have picked one of his films, you know, for this conversation as well.
But. Hey, he's still got the shout out, so don't sweat too hard. He's still got the shout out on the air.
But we were trying to be a bit obscure with our choices. You said. A bit esoteric.
Yeah. Do you have any other thoughts about After Hours and kind of like how you kind of want to channel those feelings of the night?
I think we've sort of, you know, like you say, trying to capture a vibe, you know, but it's very suspenseful. Mm. And I think Scorsese does it particularly well in his, you know, in films that go for less than 2.5 hours, yeah. Where, you know, it just, mm-hmm. there's real suspense to it. And for us, that's key. Like,
yeah,
you call late night whatever you want. It's a horror comedy, but, you know, suspense is everything for
I
us.
I think also the Griffin Dunne performance, the unraveling of that character.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
Who's trying to keep it so together on the exterior so much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, he's so underrated, Griffin Dunne, isn't he? And I don't know why he didn't really have a bigger career as an actor.
Mm.
But, you know, yeah, that performance, I don't know if we ever shared this with David or, you know, shared our love for the film or asked him to watch it.
Yes.
But I do see parallels definitely with his character and the Griffin Dunne character.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, beautiful. I absolutely love this movie. I love this pick. Let's go on to your next title, which I think, moving away from the kind of nocturnal aspect to kind of, I guess, the media satirical quality of your film. Mm. An absolute classic from Alia Kazan. One of the most prophetic films ever made, perhaps, about media. Yeah. It is his media satire, A Face in the Crowd.
Yes.
Drama.
Yes. Let's start. Where do you start with that
it's
one?
It's a tough one to start with, right? Like, when did you first come across this film? Because I would say Alia Kazan is one of the greats of cinema that a lot of people, including myself, as a Greek man who also hails from the same part of Greece as him, have complex relationships with him and his work. But
is that because of the witch hunt stuff? Or,
I come from Greek communist stock, so he was always an interesting figure in my household growing up.
Do you remember when he received the, I think it was the Thalberg Award?
Yes, at
20
the Oscars.
Years ago or so, and the response from the crowd.
Yes. I mean, people were, Ed Harris sitting on his hands. You've got De Niro and Scorsese presenting it to him. I know. Yeah. I was split. I'd be somewhere in the middle, maybe slowly, quietly clapping if I was there, because I must respect the man, but I cannot respect everything he's ever done.
Absolutely, the politics of that time were, he sold some people out, and that's not nice. But he happened to be also, you know, a great
master filmmaker.
Absolutely one of the greats. Yeah. And I think A Face in the Crowd is an interesting film because it doesn't always get held up in the conversation, especially until recently. I think when those prophecies kind of came true and rang a lot truer with this idea of, you know, a strange man who has this incredible charisma becomes so super powerful through the media and influential and using television as a tool of manipulation of the masses.
Yes.
I mean, it sounds like a familiar story the way I'm describing it now.
It sounds like, and someone who ends up in the White House, hopefully, we'll see what happens. But very much so. And there's all of that. And there's, I mean, that great, what's the name of the sort of the aphrodisiac?
Vitajex.
Yeah. Which,
The Vitajex sequence was, it was, I think, very key to us. And that final 10 minutes or so of the film, I mean, visually, I think, a big influence, not just sort of thematically.
And also like that idea of that kind of live television or the way that television can kind of communicate to an audience. That's something that you're doing very directly, whereas that film's doing it in kind of its essence. Yeah. You're doing it directly to the audience. I think that's kind of why I love horror cinema so much, because it's all about utilizing a technique to get a specific response from the audience. So it kind of has that kind of undercurrent through it as well that kind of seeps into Late Night.
That's a good point, because I guess in Face in the Crowd, it's revealing that and critiquing that. Because who's the great actress? It's
Patricia Neal.
Patricia Neal, who ends up turning up the mic, doesn't she, to reveal you know, what he really thinks of his deplorable audience or whatever. You know? Whereas we're using similar devices, but it's as if what goes to air and it gets you to question as an audience member what's the ethics of what's going on. So.
Mm.
it's a hard one to talk because it's such a different, like After Hours, you can say tonally there are similarities. Facing the Crowd, yeah, it's more of a thematic link, I guess, yeah.
How do you think that film holds up compared to kind of like the other great media satires like Network, or because it doesn't get really sung out loud as much, like how interesting or how good this film or how worthy it is?
Yeah, I don't know why it sort of got lost. I mean, it's obviously admired by filmmakers, and I see its influence in a lot of things. So, you know, I don't know why it hasn't sort of captured the imagination like, say, a Network.
Yeah.
Maybe because it's in black and white and it's 50 years old. I don't know.
I mean, Network, in this, you know, Academy, you know, Peter Finch won Best Actor, and I don't know, maybe it was a really strong year, that one, for Facing the Crowd, and it just got a bit forgotten. I don't know.
I feel like it didn't catch on at the time, but slowly people have kind of recognized it as one of Alain Kazan's most significant films.
Yeah, and ahead of its time. Yeah.
Of Kazan's oeuvre, I mean, it's kind of the odd man out, you know? That's not to say, you know, his films are conventional or anything, but you know, stylistically, I think it plays a lot differently to, you know, and on the waterfront
a bit more unconventional.
And I might even say, I'm going to say something controversial, so please don't shit me down right now. I think the Andy Griffith performance as the lead of this film of Lonesome Roads, I actually think it might be the most exciting or electrifying performance ever in any Alain Kazan film.
He's so great, isn't he? And I think it's that thing of him playing against type that worked so well, because, you know, Andy would have been America's dad at that time, or about to when he when he did his TV show. So that was like I think a casting coup. I don't know whose idea it was.
Probably Kazan's.
Assuming it was Kazan's, but a masterstroke.
Yeah. Absolutely. And just like, you know, the idea of playing with like comic energy to create some tension that feels like quite bristly, I think just works so beautifully.
Yeah. There's something quite maniacal about his performance too that, you know, could belong in a horror film. You know, he could be, if he went down a different path, he could be a maniacal serial killer, or, you know.
You know, he does remind us, like, our friend Josh Kwangtat, who plays Leo, the producer in Late Night, was also obviously the villain, the ostensible villain of Scare Campaign. And we've always thought there was a similarity, you know, between, you know, just in terms of their looks and physicality. But I think maybe that influence, it probably had an influence on Scare Campaign as well, and that character that Josh plays so well in that film.
Yeah, beautiful, beautiful. Hey, we're going to go on to your last pick. Speaking of maniacal media satires, I think you picked an absolute winner here. Halloween 3, Season of the Witch.
Horror.
I mean, for young horror fans, like, the promise of this premise being the third in the Halloween franchise, why don't we turn this whole franchise away from Michael Myers and into an anthology where once a year something crazy and different will happen. And unfortunately, that did fail. But the promise of that premise, it must have meant a lot to you guys as something quite exciting, right?
Yeah. Oh, for sure. And I'm glad it's sort of getting the respect it's due now.
Because
I
mean,
I remember when this released, I didn't want to see it because I wanted Michael Myers.
I was an affront to it, you know.
It took me a few years to get around to it. You know, I eventually probably watched it on VHS and I was like, well, I don't know, you know, what all the sort of fuss was about. Because, what a brave thing to do. Just, you know, turn your back on the franchise's, you know, key character and do, I mean, that's brave. And I could see why Carpenter wanted to do it, because he was probably thinking, well, I don't want to be stuck with this world and story. I mean, I want to try something new. I want to say something different. And, you know, I think he can be quite political at times, Carpenter, or at least he sort of smuggles in some of those, you know, ideas. That film, I think its influences are pretty obvious, really, especially towards the end.
Yes.
That idea of that body horror, I think, kind of fixes on between these two films. I've got to say, the premise of this movie kind of is there is a toy factory or mask factory is making this mask for children for Halloween that everybody loves and wants to wear, and they've got the best jingle in the entire history of cinema that inspires everyone to buy these masks. But I always have trouble trying to figure out what the master plan is behind it, because it's an indoctrination of the nation. There's a TV show that plays, a jingle that plays, and when the kids have these masks on, I believe the plan is everyone puts these masks on and then they hear the jingle on Halloween, and then their heads will turn into worms and snakes. And that is what they're trying to do.
Is that what it is?
Yeah.
Something like
it's
that.
As much,
And that's pretty horrific. I mean, that's, you know, sometimes it's better, things are better left sort of unexplained. That's that's shocking.
And that does a really good job of not explaining why, how, and what is the purpose of that.
Yeah. And look, I mean, I think, again, with Late Night, we, you know, hopefully there's enough information there for people to draw their own conclusions, but we certainly didn't go out of our way to spoon feed all the, you know, all the answers. And I think you get that in the best horror. It's good if, because ultimately it's about the fear of death, the fear of the unknown, what's out there. And if you're giving, really solid conclusions, it's suddenly a lot less scary. So, I think that's important in horror filmmaking.
The ambiguity of your mind. That's where the worms and snakes lay, is in in your brain passage.
Yes. I can feel them in the
They're wriggling. I'm feeling the wriggle right now.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's a great pick. Can I ask you guys, what do you love about this film? Like, why has it kind of stayed with you?
Yeah, look, I think it goes back to After Hours again. It's a tonal thing. And I think it's got a streak of humor through it as well, this dark humor, which, you know, we just love and try to copy.
It's almost like high stakes silliness is kind of what I really, the way I describe this film.
There's a self-awareness. They know it's absurd, but still play it straight, you know, as straight as you can. Like the jingle, but the jingle's brilliant. Like it is so.
Did Carpenter write the jingle? It's based on, what's it? Happy Halloween.
Oh my God, my head's going to turn to a snake. No.
I think it's Carpenter's voice.
Right, doing the voices.
Yeah.
But we love all that stuff, and it's kind of, it's taking something really corny, but finding something sinister in it. And I think, you know, going back to, there's a bit of that in Late Night, but certainly 100 Bloody Acres, where we've got the Morgan Brothers jingle and, you know, probably, that's sort of
the sort I know we keep referring to it as John Carpenter's.
Well, that's right.
But it's Tommy Wallace, right?
Tommy Lee Wallace.
Tommy Lee Wallace.
Yeah. Director of Fright Night 2, another underrated film.
I love Fright Night 2.
Underrated movie.
I don't know if I've seen
It's hard to get on Blu-ray, right? I think there's just like a European version.
I feel like there's a new Blu-ray for it recently. So it is worth tracking down, I think. It's worth tracking down.
Absolutely. I think it's very underrated. I watched it on YouTube, I think, because I just, I couldn't find it.
Well, we have every single movie here at the Last Video Store, so you can pop that one in your bag before you head off. And I also got to say, in that high-stakes silliness, Tom Atkins, that lead performance is so fun.
He's so committed to it. Yeah.
It's so committed, and it doesn't feel like a movie star performance. It just feels like a wild swing. And those final moments where he gets on a phone and gets a direct line to the president, I think is such funny high-stakes silliness. That just how is that possible? But they make it feel real.
Gosh.
Yes, I think we may even have stolen that line. When it's all about don't watch, right? Don't stop watching.
Exactly.
Yes.
Hey, well, Pablo Picasso said it, and so will I. I'll steal it from him. The greatest artists steal, they do not borrow.
We're certainly guilty of theft, a lot of theft. Yeah, grand larceny.
And finally, this is your beautiful three-movie combo. You've got After Hours, you've got Halloween 3, Season of the Witch, A Face in the Crowd. I think a beautiful treat, a beautiful companion piece of films to go along with Late Night with the Devil that is out now in cinemas, April 11th. Late Night with the Devil is such an absolute ripper, and I'm so excited to see it kind of like finding such a great success, especially for Australian independent horror cinema, genre cinema. I think it's the kind of stories that we make so well. well in this country. And you guys are such a testament to that genre sensibility. So I'm so excited for all the success of this film. And I can't wait to see it take over the world and turn all our heads into snakes and worms.
Thanks, mate.
The devil works in mysterious ways.
Thanks so much.
Well, my big thank yous to the makers of Late Night with the Devil for joining us on the podcast today. Thank you, David DeSmouchian, the star of Late Night with the Devil. And thank you to Colin and Cameron Kynes, the directors of Late Night with the Devil. I absolutely love this film. I think you will too. So go check it out because it is in cinemas right now. As new a release as is possible. And if you want to see it on us, we've got a few little double passes as a giveaway right now. And the way you can get that is by giving us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts and sending us a screenshot of it to our Instagram account, which is Last Video Store with Tudor. And we might pick you for one of our double pass prize packs. I'd love you to go see it, and I'd love to shout you to it, babe. And let me tell you, we can find all of their picks online for your watching. After Hours, the Martin Scorsese classic, is on Apple for VOD. You can rent that kind of thing wherever you want. If you've got the Criterion channel, yes, I respect you, and it is on there. A Face in the Crowd is on Binge. Isn't that weird? I think that's actually weird they have it on there. That's exciting. Halloween 3 Season of the Witch, it is on Stan. So you can check it out there. And I'm going to give you a little extra recommendation just for you guys. One of my favorite David DeSmouchian films is a film called Relaxer. It is a really small micro-budget, two-hander, independent, weirdo genre film from a great genre filmmaker, Joel Patricus, in America. I love that film. It is on Amazon Prime, so you can watch that. There's also a great Blu-ray that I own in the video store. You can borrow that one if you come on here. So, yeah, hit me up if you're ever on the podcast. I'll put that in your deal for you. Until then, find us on Instagram. Message me if you want to. And all I want to say to you is, in the meantime, I love you, and I love movies even more than I love you. It's the thing I love most in the world.